can they assure us that wells that they have no data for aren't a problem? That's what really worries me.
Alaska officials ask BLM to clean up old oil well sites. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a massive landslide remodels the landscape in Glacier Bay National Park.
It was apparent that it was a landslide and it filled the entire valley.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
Officials from the state of Alaska urged a U.S. Senate panel today for help in remediating wells in the National Petroleum Reserve. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the hearing illustrated a deep divide between a state and federal agency.
The massive reserve lies more than 200 miles north of the Arctic Circle, out of the view of many. The NPRA, as it's known in Washington speak, is home to 136 wells that the federal government, namely the U.S. Navy and U.S. Geological Survey, drilled. Just over a dozen have been sealed, some by the Bureau of Land Management and others by the North Slope Borough.
They're environmental eyesores at best and potential sources for hazardous fluid contamination at worst.
That's Kathy Forrester. She's chair of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission and testified before the Senate Energy Committee. She's describing the varying conditions of the wells and pits, areas littered with wood, metal, and all sorts of drilling rig detritus. But it's not her agency that oversees the legacy wells. That falls under the purview and budget of the BLM. And the two agencies don't agree on exactly how many wells are left uncapped or what condition the sealed ones are actually in. The two agencies have different standards. And Forrester worries because some of the holes date back to World War II. The BLM does not have adequate data on all of the wells in the reserve.
How can they assure us that wells that they have no data for aren't a problem? That's what really worries me.
On hearing this, Senator Lisa Murkowski, who at times had to play mediator, turned to Bud Cribley, the BLM director for Alaska, for his take. Are there, in fact, wells out there the BLM knows little or nothing about?
Well, that's probably true, yes. I mean, we're based, everything that we have are based on wells that have been drilled for a large number of years, and a lot of those a long time ago.
Cribley vowed the two agencies will work together and forge ahead towards agreements on the numbers and status of wells. But to Senator Murkowski, those promises did not appear to be enough.
Well, I appreciate your words, but I also recognize that it is literally taking an act of Congress to get the Department of Interior, to get BLM to step up to its responsibility. That ought not to be the case.
Cribley says the BLM is crafting a 3-year plan for capping 13 of the highest priority wells, and it will likely start with Ico Bay Well Number 1. He says he has to be realistic about what kind of money his agency can expect from federal coffers. It's spent more than $80 million over the past decade capping wells, including two this year near Umiat, and it will likely get less money in the future. But State Representative Charisse Millett is not satisfied with BLM's projections. She says the federal government has had decades to clean up the mess, and 13 wells over 3 years is not fast enough. To her, it shows an attitude that the federal government does not abide by the strict environmental standards it imposes on private companies. So, she says, there are options.
The administration is planning more offshore Alaska and NPRA lease sales. Let's use a portion of those revenues and plug the abandoned wells and clean up the Arctic tundra. Another option is to lease the well sites to private operators to clean up, as a lease requirement, those well sites.
Indeed, companies have told state regulators the resource potential is worth the cleanup costs. Kathy Forrester says one option is off the table. The state cannot block the federal government from holding future lease sales.
My attorneys tell me that feds trump state, and while we can find them to be in violation of our laws, we cannot find them, we cannot exert our authority over them. All we can do is embarrass them in the court of public opinion.
And that intent was clearly on display. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Shell is facing another unexpected hurdle in its plan to drill exploratory wells in the Arctic Ocean this summer. The company is asking the Environmental Protection Agency to revise its air permit for one of its drill ships. The normal revision process would take months, but the EPA is considering options that would allow Shell to proceed this summer. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Shell says it can't meet the requirements in its air quality permit from the EPA for its Discoverer drill ship. The company is planning to use the ship to drill up to three exploratory wells in the Chukchi Sea beginning in early August. The problem is with the generators that run the drilling unit's engines on the ship. Shell spokesman Curtis Smith says the company believes no engines currently on the market could meet the requirements.
We used multiple filters. We used custom-fit E-pods, ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel, all as a mitigation effort to get the emission standards to a place that we could meet them. We showed EPA that work and then together realized that that limit may not be achievable through conventional methods.
Shell is applying for a compliance order from the EPA, which would allow the company to go ahead with drilling this summer. Then Shell would be required to go through a full public process to revise its air quality permit ahead of the 2013 drilling season. Rick Albright is a director in the Seattle EPA office. He says the agency is considering granting the compliance order and other options that would allow for drilling in the Chukchi this season, but hasn't decided how to proceed.
We're going to have to look at what's in their application first and make sure that we understand what they're asking for, what the modifications are. No matter what happens, we're going to ensure that air quality is protected.
Albright says if the EPA decides to issue a compliance order, it could be in place in a matter of weeks. Environmental groups hope that doesn't happen. Rebecca Noblin is the Alaska director for the Center for Biological Diversity. She says the air quality permit revision is an example of Shell reneging on its promises at the 11th hour.
I think it's very unfair to the local communities that are going to be impacted by this pollution for Shell to be at the last minute saying, hey, we're not going to make our promise. Can we get a waiver? I honestly don't know whether it's legal under the Clean Air Act, but I certainly question the fairness of it.
Shell says it's confident EPA will grant a compliance order for the Discoverer. The company's drill ship that will work in the Beaufort, the Kulluk, is not affected by the same problem. The Discoverer is currently in Dutch Harbor, and the Kulluk is scheduled to arrive there soon. Another headache for Shell is the unusually heavy sea ice that remains in both the Beaufort and the Chukchi Seas. The company is watching it closely and expects it to retreat enough by the first week of August to allow drilling to begin. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
An interim voter district map is in place for this fall's election, but the state's redistricting process is far from over. Alaska Redistricting Board Chairman John Torgerson says lawsuits challenging the redraw of Alaska's voting districts remain in play.
All of the underlying issues that were brought up in trial are still pending. The Supreme Court hasn't ruled on anything.
The primary legal challenge to the proposed new voter district map is from two Fairbanks residents who live in Esther and Goldstream, areas lumped into a massive voter district that extends west to the Bering Sea. The lawsuit filed last year contends the grouping disenfranchises the plaintiffs, but also challenges other aspects of the voter map, some of which have been addressed in subsequent changes. There have also been legal challenges to redrawn districts in southeast Alaska. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, ravens tear up golf courses across southeast.
It's sad. I don't like to see the golf course in this kind of shape, but there's not much we can do about it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The Nome Volunteer Fire Department responded to an early morning fire in Teller, flying in six firefighters who were later joined by several vehicles loaded with crew and equipment. KNOM's Matthew Smith has the story.
The first group of firefighters arrived in Teller just before 5 o'clock this morning. The fire, burning since 2 a.m., had engulfed the old Teller Commercial Company building, the former store known as the Blodgett Building, as well as an old abandoned house next to it. The flames had also spread to the Mary's Igloo office and its nearby storage shed. The flames were threatening the Teller Catholic Church, as well as the community power plant. The wind was beginning to bring smoke to buildings adjacent to the fire. Many of those buildings were abandoned, described as tinderboxes by firemen on the scene. Nome Fire Chief Matt Johnson.
Well, we took one of them and we took a two-story structure with a loader and pushed it onto the pile so that it would stop the fire spread to the Catholic Church and the Evec power plant.
Additional firefighters arrived in Teller around 7 o'clock this morning. Johnson says they used the City of Teller loader to tear down three buildings and move other structures away from the fire. NVFD turned its hoses onto the church and used the loader to push a vacant building that sat between the church and the blaze toward the fire. When it collapsed, it fell toward the fire and prevented damage to the church. But then Johnson says the loader itself caught fire.
It fell into a utility door that's buried in the ground and was unable to get back out. And fortunately, the firefighter that was operating it was able to get out okay. And unfortunately, we lost the loader, but we didn't lose anybody.
The loader eventually exploded, first the fuel tank and then its four massive tires, and it was completely gutted by the fire. Johnson says the blaze was fully contained around 9 a.m. No injuries were reported. NVFD continued using heavy equipment from the City of Teller to move charred debris and extinguish any remaining hazards. Cora Oblowalik is the tribal coordinator for Mary's Igloo Traditional Council. She said that she and some co-workers were able to enter their office before it caught fire and salvage computers and tribal documents, as well as materials for a culture camp being held on July 22nd.
Oh, we're still going to go. We got most of our important camp stuff here. Got them all out of the warehouse and the building, so we're still going to have it. Building or no building, I mean, we'll still have a tribe.
Johnson says the fire marshal is now trying to determine how it will get investigators to Teller. Johnson and his crew secured the perimeter before returning to Nome just before noon. Alaska State Troopers were on the scene and taking control of what is still considered a crime scene. Johnson says it will be up to the fire marshal's office to determine the cause of the fire. From KNOM in Nome, I'm Matthew Smith.
The Alaska Marine Highway System has concluded that a maneuvering error by the captain of the state ferry Matanuska resulted in the May 7th crash with a seafood processing plant in Petersburg. The accident shut down the Ocean Beauty Seafood Cannery for this year. KFSK's Joe Vicknicki reports.
The 408-foot passenger ferry rammed into the Ocean Beauty plant just after 1 o'clock on May 7th, smashing the wooden concrete dock and the cannery building. The Marine Highway System came out this month with the results of its internal investigation of the accident. Ferry System Chief Mike Neusel says the Matanuska's captain tried to get out of a strong tidal current pushing it south in the Wrangell Narrows towards Petersburg's ferry terminal.
He was attempting to maneuver the ship over to the Petersburg town side of the channel to get into that back eddy area where there's less current that's pushing him rapidly towards the Marine Highway dock, so that he has, so he can slow down and make a more controlled approach into the Marine Highway dock. Unfortunately, the maneuver he executed was a pretty severe left-hand turn to get out of the main channel over towards the Petersburg town side, and then even with full right rudder and differential thrust on the shafts, could not get back to make a right-hand turn to turn away from that dock and parallel the town side.
The report says the vessel's master at the time of the accident, Scott McCauley, is one of the most experienced ship handlers in the fleet with over 29 years of deck officer experience. The accident happened just about 2 hours before the high tide that afternoon, and it was one of the bigger tides of the month. The current in the Wrangell Narrows at the time of the crash was estimated around 4 to 5 knots. The vessel's crew members underwent the mandatory alcohol and drug testing following the incident, and results all came back negative. Mechanical problems also did not factor into the crash. However, the Marine Highways investigation noted concern by prior captains that the Matanuska's steering is less responsive than its sister ships, the Taku and the Malaspina. Neusel says the Marine Highway System will take steps to avoid a similar accident in the future.
The whole purpose of the investigation really is to learn lessons, what happened, why it happened, how it happened, and then to spread that information amongst the rest of the fleet so that they can consider that in their future ship maneuvers.
The report says the crew was not negligent in its duties and took the right actions to try and slow the vessel as it hit the cannery. The report recommends administrative actions for the crew, but says that those internal personnel matters would not be made public. The ferry sustained only scraped paint and some dents. Ocean Beauty decided not to operate its processing plant in the building this summer because of the accident. The company's vice president of marketing, Tom Sunderland, says they plan to have the plant open again in 2013. Sunderland says Ocean Beauty is doing repair work to the cannery this summer and fall and won't have a dollar amount for the damage until after that work is complete. The U.S. Coast Guard has not yet completed a separate investigation of the incident. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
One of the biggest landslides in the Western Hemisphere took place last month in the mountains of Glacier Bay National Park. It was spotted late last month by air taxi pilot Drake Olson, who takes park visitors out flight seeing. A huge swath, about 5 miles, of the Johns Hopkins Glacier was covered with a blanket of dirt and rock. Olson says it is territory he's familiar with, and it has changed dramatically.
You just can't miss this, yeah. It's huge, and it's so out of context for what you see out there that it just sticks out like a sore thumb.
The Park Service confirms that a large part of the top of Latuya Mountain apparently just fell off on June 11th. Seismic networks in Canada and the U.S. picked up the impact at the time, but nobody located the site of the landslide until Olson's flight seeing trip.
It stuck out like a sore thumb, and then further exploration, you know, we just headed for it and really looked it over, and it was apparent that it was a landslide, and it filled the entire valley.
The slide is near the summit of Latuya Mountain, more than a dozen miles up the glacier from tidewater. Park Service Resource Manager Allison Banks says the slide is not going to be a threat anytime soon.
The area that the landslide took place in is quite a distance from any coastline. And it's also an area that visitors really don't reach. So we'd be surprised if anybody would have even detected it other than an aircraft overhead.
Scientists and park rangers can only speculate about what caused the colossal slide. Climate warming could have been involved, but whether the slide happened because of reduced support from shrinking glaciers, decaying permafrost up on the mountain, lubrication and added weight from recent heavy snow and rain, or a combination of all those factors is simply not known.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Meridian Management, specializing in coordination and management of all phases of construction projects from vision to completion, working to ensure that your project is on time and on budget. More at meridianak.com. As long as there are veterans, the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks will never forget them. Throughout the year, Elks members in your community lend a hand, donate money, and volunteer time. It's not something they feel they have to do, it's something they want to do. Join with America's veterans in saluting the efforts of your local Elks Lodge. Information at elks.org. Elks care, Elks share. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Elks Association.
Alaska state troopers have called off the search for a Delta Junction man missing since last weekend. Emmanuel Martin Hoser's car was found parked at a bluff overlooking the Tanana River Sunday night. The 20-year-old was last seen by family Saturday evening. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
George Hoser was pacing Wednesday afternoon around the impromptu search and rescue command post, trying to stay optimistic that the small army of searchers who were looking for his son, Martin, would yet find him alive, perhaps injured from a fall off the bridge or maybe the 500-foot bluff nearby that's a popular local hiking attraction. Despite his stiff upper lip, it was clear that the strain and worry that he'd endured increasingly since Martin was reported missing more than 48 hours earlier, was beginning to take a toll.
There's always hope, and we can't give up hope until we've eliminated all those options. However, in my mind, based on my knowledge of him, the clues at the scene, the most likely scenario is that he was probably climbing on the bridge and slipped and fell in the river.
Hozier said that the dozens of volunteers had so far failed to find Martin or his body. As much as he'd like to believe otherwise, he's bracing for the worst. He says he's grateful that so many members of the community turned out to help.
I am humbled and blessed by everybody in the community that has turned out with all the effort and the sacrifice.
Reporting from Big Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska students are making their own lives better, according to a national survey that assesses the risks they take. The Youth Risk Behavior Survey shows the state's kids are smoking less, having less unprotected sex, taking fewer drugs, and drinking less alcohol than in previous years. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Students at Alaska's traditional high schools have made improvements in 14 of the 20 risk categories that are considered by the Federal Center for Disease Control. Statistically, they showed no change in four categories, and the only category in which they showed an increase was the use of condoms. The CDC began accumulating the risk behavior data nationwide in 1990, and compared to students from the other 42 states that take part in it, Alaska students in the 2011 survey showed equal or lower risk in 18 of those categories. Wendy Hamilton coordinates the survey for the Department of Health and Social Services. She says improvements came about because of the way the survey results have been used over the years.
It's because of targeted interventions that agencies can make in those areas. And in tobacco and alcohol, targeted grant programs that get down in the community level that can start making a difference in youth risk behavior.
The statewide survey anonymously asks about 1,500 students in 43 schools about their own behavior. She says the data is broken out by region and district.
We do know that there is more smoking in the Southwest region. We do know there's more chew in the Southwest region. In certain areas, there's more drinking than the state average. But it gives communities a really good bird's eye view of what's going on in their community and where they need to focus prevention activities and dollars.
Patty Owen is the health and safety coordinator for the Department of Education. She works with the survey results in targeting ways to improve violent conditions. She says it gives the department, school districts, and parents the evidence they need.
Looking at dating violence, we know that 12% of high school students have been physically hurt by a boyfriend or girlfriend in the past year, and 15% of students have been electronically bullied in the past 12 months. This is new information. We hear it, but now we have the actual number. And we know about 1 in 5 high school students report being bullied on school property. So, yeah, we look at that, and then we can see how we can decrease those numbers.
The survey also finds very different results for students in alternative schools, those for students considered at risk. Where in traditional schools, 24% of students had been in a fight in the previous year, in alternative schools, the survey showed 44% had fought. Other comparisons, for example, show 14% of traditional students had smoked, 48% of alternative students had smoked. Alternative schools had not been included in the study prior to 2009, so there's not enough evidence to show any trend. However, Owen says there's already enough information to focus efforts on some of those categories. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Golfers aren't the only ones on the course in Wrangell. They're joined by a group of ravens who are causing extensive damage. Golf courses throughout Southeast are experiencing a similar problem. KSTK's Ann Hillman has the story.
Shannon Booker drives around Wrangell's 9-hole golf course in a cart, pointing out areas of destruction.
And they started out in the wet, mossy areas, and now they've graduated not only in the wet, mossy areas, but you can see the wet, grassy areas as well.
Ravens have torn extensive holes in the fairways of the course with their beaks and feet. It looks like a farmer went through with a rototiller to prepare the land for planting.
We have AstroTurf for greens, and had we have had natural grass, I think that the Ravens' destruction would put us under. I don't think that
we would be able to survive if they had torn into the greens.
As it is, they've had to reroute two of the holes to avoid the damage and make allowances for players to move their balls out of the rough areas with no penalty.
No closer to the green, of course.
Booker says this is the first time ravens have extensively damaged the fairways since the course opened in 2001. Local gardener Susan Wiseagle says the birds are likely going after crane fly larvae and pupae. The large mosquito-like bugs are starting to appear in Wrangell later this season than in other years. Other golf courses in Southeast, both north and south of here, are having similar problems. Morgan DeBauer is the owner and manager of Mount Fairweather Golf Course in Gustavus. He says the ravens started picking at his course last year, but this year the damage is much worse, and he can't do much about it.
They're pulling up the moss with just a little bit of dirt with it, and I can come along and mow it, and it kind of dissipates it. But if it's wet, it's just like mowing paste.
But he thinks, ultimately, the birds may be helping.
And I figure they're actually doing a long-term benefit. You know, the way Mother Nature works, benefit is that they're aerating the ground.
DeBauer says he thinks they're controlling pest outbreaks as well. Roger Sundovich at the golf course in Sitka says they were having problems with ravens ripping up the fairways earlier this summer, but they've already stopped picking at the grubs. He says it's a tough situation because the ravens are causing hundreds of thousands of dollars of damage, but you can't do much about it. Ravens are protected by the International Migratory Bird Treaty, and to kill or remove them, you have to get a special permit. Additionally, Don Hutchinson-Stevens, a member of the Kiksadi Raven Clan, says the birds are significant to the Tlingit.
The raven is important to us because he brought us the sun, moon, stars, and he's also a trickster. He's much smarter and prettier than the eagle, as far as I'm concerned. I'm a raven, so.
She says the birds are viewed as the clan's ancestors, and injuring them insults members of the Raven Clan. Booker at the Wrangell Golf Course says they do not plan to hurt the protected birds.
It's sad. I don't like to see the golf course in this kind of shape, but there's not much we can do about it.
For now, playing around the destruction is just a new added challenge to the course. I'm Ann Hillman in Wrangell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Matthew Smith in Nome, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Margaret Friednauer in Haines, Tim Ellis in Big Delta, and Ann Hillman in Wrangell. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau, Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth, and organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. Avtech is recruiting rural Alaskans for computer and network training with no cost tuition for qualified applicants. For more about the Village Internet Agent Program, call 1-800-478-5389. This message sponsored by Avtech, Alaska's Institute of Technology.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers competitive interest rates with programs tailored for first-time homebuyers and home choice seminars that cover the details of purchasing and financing a home. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.